The name of this case is TW and AW versus Adoption and Choices of Colorado and MC. May I have future appearances, please?
Good afternoon, Massachusetts Attorney Judge McCrario, registration number 26137, here on behalf of the petitioner.
Thank you. Have a seat, Counsel Phil.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Hudson Madsen, registration number 38221, the favor.
And are you going to speak as well, Ms. Madsen?
Your Honor, Mr. Kuchin Judge will take the lead on the argument, and I'll be available for questions.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And on this side of the room.
On this side of the room, good afternoon. My name is Scott Lasher. I represent, along with Kevin Snodgrass and the associate members of Marcus Cronin, represent the respondent.
Okay, very good. This case has been set for 1 hour. That means that each side has 30 minutes, which means, Mr. Treasurer and Ms. Madsen, if you are going to split time, you need to make that decision yourselves. And also, if you wish to reserve any time, you need to do that yourself as well. You'll be able to do so just by watching the clock count down. It's pretty easy. I should also note, thank you, for the record that Justice Marquez is not going to be participating in this case. She's not here and she is not going to be participating. And with those preliminary comments, I think we're ready to go. So, Mary, you're ready, sir.
Madam Chief Justice, fellow justices, I'm appearing on behalf of the adoptive parents in this matter. I'll present the oral argument on behalf of both petitioners, though I expect to defer any questions on issue 3, which is the issue regarding the single child support payment, to Counsel Madsen, who represents the adoption agency.
Mr. Cooper, can I ask a favor? Can you lower that microphone just
yes.
A little bit?
Of course, make sure I can hear you. Thank you. We're here today to discuss some weighty issues, including liberty interests and statutory interpretation and construction. Underlying all of these discussions, however, is the life and the welfare of two young children who are 2 years and almost 9 months old as I stand here today. As we consider the relevant issues, we must include as an important factor that these two boys are growing up as we wrangle this case through different levels of the court process. They were 5 months old when this process started. They're now 2 years and nearly 9 months old. Their needs and their relationships and their attachments continue to evolve every day. The issue of the liberty interests at play here further instructs us as to how to view the rights of each party and helps us to determine how the relevant statute should be interpreted. So that is to say, through the termination statute, which is found at CRS section 19-5-105 and CRS section 19-5-214, which deals with circumstances in which adoption may be annulled, do they properly take into account and balance all of the liberty interests that are implicated in a case such as this one? In its opinion, the Court of Appeals found that only MC had a liberty interest, but that neither the children nor adoptive parents had any such interest. Based on this finding, the Court of Appeals proceeded to eviscerate the termination statute and ignore the terms of CRS section 19-5-214. And when I say eviscerate the termination statute, what they did is take three bases for termination under 19-5-105 and essentially render it down to one, which is a question of fitness, not a question of whether a substantial positive relationship was established between a birth father and the child or children, and whether the birth father had taken substantial parental responsibility regarding the child. In its opinion, the Court of Appeals added a new special presumption in favor of MC and then reinterpreted the statute. As I just mentioned, by adding that new special presumption, the Court of Appeals effectively removed two of the three criteria for termination set forth in the statute. The Court of Appeals then went on to reassess the evidence and make its own findings, essentially just invading the province of the trial court. And finally, the trial court ignored So the Court of Appeals ignored subsection 3.2 of the termination statute, which provides that the children's needs are of paramount importance and that the trial court must consider the psychological harm that would, the likelihood of psychological harm that would inure to the children if they were removed from their current custodians. So let's turn to the liberty interests that should apply in this case. First, and contrary to the briefing presented by MC and his counsel, adoptive parents have never contested that MC has some liberty interest. Going back to Santosky versus Kramer, it's clear that there is some liberty interest that attaches. But adoptive parents have simply maintained throughout this process that his liberty interest is yet one of the three liberty interests that are implicated here. The other two interests that we argue should apply here are based on the existence of a familial relationship, and our contention is that the relationship itself is entitled to protection. Adoptive parents argue today, as they have throughout this case, that they and the children each also have liberty interests which must be considered. The adoptive parents' liberty interest stems from their custodial relationship, the familial relationship with the children. In the case by this court, MS versus People, the court found the same thing, which was, although in that specific situation, in that specific case, there was not a reasonable expectation of permanence, there clearly was in this situation. There clearly was with adopted parents from the time that they took placement of the children for purposes of adoption, took them into their home, when they were at the hospital with them when they were born, took them home, raised them as their own, and on December 27, 2012, formalized that relationship by entries of decrees of adoption that were entered. They clearly, from the beginning and throughout that entire process, had a reasonable expectation that their relationship was not just as foster parents, but was a permanent relationship and would be a permanent relationship with the children. So under MS versus People, because there was the expectation of a permanent relationship being formed, that gives rise to a constitutional interest, a fundamental liberty interest that attaches in favor of the adoptive parents with regards to the children. Now, once the decrees of adoption were entered, both federal and Colorado case law provide that adoptive parents have the same rights and interests as would biological parents. That's found in Inree CA, Colorado Supreme Court case, and Smith versus Organization of Foster Families, a U.S. Supreme Court case from 1977. But regardless of the adoption decrees, our contention is the familial relationship that has been established that is entitled to protection. Again, that's been enunciated by the U.S. Supreme Court, both in Lehrer versus Robertson and Smith versus Organization of Foster Families, among others. And as I said before, because of the expectation that the relationship would become permanent under Colorado law as well, there gives rise to a liberty interest on behalf of the adoptive parents. Now, perhaps most important here is the rights of the children. There is or should be no doubt that the children have certain rights as well. The extent of those rights and the protection that those rights afford these children is a matter of first impression in Colorado. Despite what the statute says, CR section 19.5.105, specifically subsection 3.2, that addresses the children's needs, that state that they are of paramount importance and that the trial court must look at the likelihood of psychological harm if the children were removed from their custodians, this is a matter of first impression for this court. Now, the extent of those rights and protection of those rights afford the children has been addressed in some manner in numerous other states. That would include, by way of example, California, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Florida, New Mexico, Texas, Oregon, New York, Illinois, Washington, and Wyoming. Those states have, in one form or another, already determined that children have liberty interests that attach to their familial relationships. The U.S. Supreme Court, in the case Trostle versus Randall, which is part of the basis of the request for certiorari before this court, has opined that children likely have liberty interests that are equivalent to the parents' liberty interests. I believe that was Justice Stevens in a dissenting opinion in a plurality decision who opined that they have liberty interests that are equivalent to the parents' liberty interests. We therefore ask this court today to determine what rights and interests the children have in this situation, and to find that their rights are equivalent in this circumstance to the rights that any of the adults or parents would have in this case. As compared to adoptive parents or to NC, the children are in the most vulnerable position as they do not have the ability at their age to provide for their own physical, emotional, psychological, or educational needs.
Counsel, let me just stop you there because I think you're talking about these rights in the abstract, and I'm hoping you can apply them to the case here and how this would weigh out. I mean, essentially, you set forth that everyone has rights.
Yes.
I appreciate your position on that, but how do they, I guess you're saying that the children's rights have to be paramount and they trump the other rights, or they trump the father's rights at least?
Well, we believe what the law provides for is they are at least equivalent. Essentially, our position is that in terms of trying to understand how to balance these interests, that we believe that the statute, CRS section 19.5105, as well as 19.5214, are the proper structure by which we actually determine these interests and how these interests are balanced against each other.
So essentially, are you saying, to what extent do we even need to discuss what you've just discussed when you say that they are properly expressed in the statute? Are we really just looking at the statute?
I believe that's accurate, Your Honor. I mean, from our position, the trial court did exactly what it was supposed to do, which is it applied the statute. It looked at 19.5105, it applied all of the factors in the statute, and based upon that roadmap, as the trial judge called it, I believe on page one of his termination order, said, this is the roadmap that tells me how to deal with all of these issues. And that's what he did, and we believe that was the proper way to go through this process and to assess it. Now, just to add to that, the reason that we're addressing these additional rights is because of the Court of Appeals opinion, which essentially elevated birth father's rights and then laid waste to everybody else's rights. Nobody else has rights. The birth father has the rights. He was the only one. That's why we come back and talk about the fact that there are multiple rights that everybody has that need to be considered in balance. But on balance, what we do is we go back to 19.5105. That addresses the birth father's rights, and it also addresses the children's rights. Now, the adoptive parents' rights are not in that section per se, unless and until there is not a termination of his parental rights. That would be addressed, we believe, in this context under 19.5214, which protects the familial relationship, as I mentioned before. Now, in terms of 19.5105, the way that birth father's rights are protected is that there are three limited bases upon which the trial court may terminate his rights. Three and only three limited bases. It's not up to the discretion of the court as to whether under these circumstances or under those circumstances they believe that rights should be terminated. Three limited bases. In addition to that, under the Santosky decision, there is also a finding that has to be made by clear and convincing evidence. So it's an elevated standard. Those are the protections, essentially, that are afforded to birth father. It's those protections that give the trial court the opportunity to make its determination as to what is appropriate and whether the termination is appropriate. Now, with regards to the children's interest, that's protected by subsection 3.2 of the statute, which, Your Honor, as you said, states that the children's rights are of paramount importance. It does say that, and it says that the trial court must consider the likelihood of significant psychological harm to the children if they're removed from their caregivers. The trial court did all. The trial court went through the three bases for termination. The trial court looked at subsection 3.2. I believe he spent about 5.5 pages on the best interests of the children, the needs of the children. He heard from multiple witnesses, multiple expert witnesses, as well as the guardian ad litem. So he went exhaustively through that process, and through that analysis, through that roadmap, found the termination was appropriate. We believe he acted properly in that case, and 19.5105 is what
So essentially, just to conclude, essentially you're saying we should just reinstate what the trial court did and actually just excise all the Troxell analysis that the Court of Appeals added.
Yes.
Well, and that's actually a perfect segue to my question, Mr. Kukasia, is does 19.5105 adequately capture the father's right to care, custody, and control. We don't have to call it a trotsal right, but clearly he has a constitutionally protected interest as a fit parent in the care, custody, and control, right? So even if we were to conclude that the Court of Appeals sort of went overboard with the trotsal analysis, does the statute alone capture the father's interest here? And if not, what should we do to try and capture his interest?
Yes, it does capture the interest, and here's how, Your Honor. I believe under Laird versus Robertson, the U.S. Supreme Court said that biology itself doesn't vest all of the rights and all of the interests. That actually does give some interest and some protection to the birth father, but it is the custodial relationship that vests the full level of rights, as we want to call them, that is recognized under trotsal. When we refer to trotsal presumption, we state that if there is essentially a fit custodial parent, they are entitled to deference, and that in the event that a trial court wants to impinge upon any of their rights, any of their decisions, it has to set forth special factors, and then there's a finding by clear and convincing evidence of those factors. So we don't go that far in this situation. Under 19.5105, subsection 3.1a, that's the fitness standard. That says, is the parent fit? And it has a number of different issues that you can look at. Now, in terms of the custodial part, that really gets dealt with under subsection 3.1b, which is, has the birth parent established a substantial positive relationship with the child? So that allows the birth parents to try to form a relationship with the child for the trial court to make a determination as to whether that relationship is sufficient, not in the abstract, but in the specific, whether this birth parent knows this child well enough, understands the child's needs well enough, has been able to provide for the child's needs well enough in order to properly parent and effectively parent the child. Likewise, the child would be looking, does the child look to that parent as, or to that person as the person who is providing their care and nurture and support. So that's where we get to. Fit parent gets, under Santosky, fit parent gets the benefit of the evidence standard, which is clear and convincing evidence is what has to be the standard if there's going to be a termination. And then 3.1b of the termination statute then allows birth father in this case to show that he is or has been or can be a custodial parent. If he becomes a fit custodial parent, then you get the trotsal presumption, not until that point. So I believe that 19.5105 does adequately address those issues and give protection to the birth father in this situation.
So I suppose that gets us then to the issue of whether the findings were sufficient, Judge Lass's findings were sufficient with respect to the fitness of the parents. And more particularly to the issue of the payment, the child support payment.
Yes, ma'am.
So I know your co-counsel wants to talk about, but I would like to ask her about that. So.
Okay, then I'll defer to
thank you,
Ms. Madsen.
Sorry to interrupt, but this is a good logical place for me. So tell me about that, if you would. There's a $100 payment, that's all, but there are some conjecture, at least, that it might have been difficult to arrange for more. Just tell me what, from your point of view, the situation is.
Well, the payment was actually a one-time payment of $250, correct. And it was also argued that the birth father expended additional monies for travel or to practices to exercise his parenting time with the children in terms of buying supplies, stroller, things to assist in that. My argument is that those are not considered child support payments or payments in support of the children. Those were payments that assisted the father in exercising his parenting time. They did not go to the daily care of the children. They did not improve the daily lives of the children, which in terms of providing substantial financial responsibility, that is the intent of that statute to do that. The other issue is that the issue of child support was raised by the trial court during the status conference on June 27th of 2013. The issue was out there. However, the birth father at no point requested an order for child support. So that renders many of his arguments irrelevant.
The trial court promptly considered the factors that it had for it. Had there been a child support order, yes, the trial court should have considered the adoptive parent's financial information, because that would have been required in terms of sworn financial affidavits. In developing a child support order, the trial court as well could have considered father's travel expenses, could have considered father's expenditures on strollers, toys, supplies. However, because there was no order, the trial court was not obligated or mandated to consider those factors, and the trial court did not abuse its discretion in only considering that one-time payment.
Counsel, can I just get you to focus on the trial court's order? Essentially, the trial court didn't rely, that was not the gist of the termination order. Essentially, the trial court summarizes essentially that the father hasn't established a substantial positive relationship. That's kind of the gist of the order.
Sure.
Okay. So help me understand then how this idea about the payment or lack thereof actually can sustain the termination.
Well, there are the three factors that, in terms of terminating father's parental rights. The one-time payment, father had a duty of supports. There is a common law duty of a parent to provide child support with or without a court order. Father was on notice that when his parental rights were reinstated, he was on notice that he had a duty to provide support. He only provided $250 over a three-month period. And it seemed pretty clear that he had the opportunity or the ability to provide more, but he did not. So the one-time payment of $250 is not taking substantial responsibility for the children, especially twins when you have two children.
Well, I guess we're trying to get, and maybe we all are confusing you by not knowing which attorney to ask these questions of, but I guess I'm trying to get to, perhaps Justice Hyde as well, a greater understanding of the factors upon which the trial judge based his decision to terminate and to what extent the child support did or did not constitute a primary reason for that termination. I don't care who answers. I would like an answer. Thank you. Sorry to shuffle you around this.
And I'll try to give you that answer.
Okay.
So under 19.5105, we've got the three different bases for termination. The second basis is whether a parent has established a substantial positive relationship
right.
with the child. And we're focusing on the third, which is, has the parent taken substantial parental responsibility of the child? That includes a duty of support. So as we have in general, we've got two different things. We've got rights in order to have the child in our care, custody, and control, but we also have a concomitant obligation to provide for that child. And so two of the three bases are, look at the relationship, and the third one is, has the parent stepped up and taken responsibility and provided support for the child? So somebody has to provide support for the child, the children in this situation. And so the question becomes, under that subsection of the statute, has the birth father paid regular and reasonable support according to his means? And so that was one of the two bases for termination by the trial court judge here. And the finding was specifically based upon, and I believe that the trial court judge said there can be no question that he has failed to provide regular and reasonable support according to his means. Though there was evidence presented about the expenses that birth father incurred in order to have visits here in Colorado with the children, the statement was also made by the trial court judge that there can be no question that these did not provide for the support of the children. So what do the children in general need? They need food, they need clothing, they need childcare. They need toys, clothing, I mean, all of this. And one payment of $250 essentially made as a last-ditch effort just shortly before the termination hearing is what was made here. At the hearing, Earthfather even admitted that he did not believe he had an obligation to provide support for the children until he got his visits and he got what he wanted. So that's where that was a basis for termination, a valid basis for termination. It's not just I get, and you know, to the extent we deal with this in custody or dissolution of marriage context, it's the same thing. Your parenting time and your support obligation are not dependent upon each other. You don't only pay child support.
Sure. I mean, we understand that. And this is a little bit more than just dividing up parenting time, though. I mean,
right.
And I think that's the concern that these pages, the judge's findings with respect to this seem perhaps not as thorough as one might hope, given that this is a termination proceeding as opposed to just dividing up parenting time.
I think there are a few different factors that get considered under the subsection 3.1c in terms of taking substantial parental responsibility. He did meet some of those requirements, and the trial court acknowledged those. But when it came to the support piece, in essence, there was very little more for the trial court judge to do because there was only the one thing. The trial court had raised the issue of support at the June 27th telephone status conference, and then no action was taken essentially until September of 2013, 3 weeks or so prior to the termination hearing before one payment was made. That just doesn't fall within the criteria of regular and reasonable support according to his means. And by his own admission at the hearing, that $250 payment wasn't as much as he could do. It was what he thought he should be responsible for based on the visits he had gotten. So in terms of what the trial court judge did, it was a very narrow slice of what there was for him to do based on the very limited history of any payments and any support he had provided.
Mr. Kukesha, can you speak to the standard of review issue when we're talking just about those findings that Judge Lass made with respect to the statute? Would it be abuse of discretion that we would be looking at, or clearly erroneous?
I think it would be the clearly erroneous standard. Essentially, we would look at this as a sufficiency of the evidence. Was there enough evidence in the trial court record for the finding to be sustained? And I've got about 5.5 minutes left. If I could reserve the rest of that for...
Sure, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Lesh.
Can't please the court. It's actually overwhelming, the thought that we devoted 100,000 words or more in this court, probably that many in the Court of Appeals, and a zillion more in the trial court. My hope is that you will have read carefully what I wrote, what's been written by the other side, what's been written by the amicus briefs and the amicus briefs. What I want to do today is, it's interesting that you raised Justice Hood. I have 30 minutes somehow to deal with this. I'd like you to indulge me for two or three of those 30 minutes and allow me to read something to you, and I feel that it is particularly relevant to what you asked. We are firmly of the opinion that in all cases of this character, the presumption is that the parents are fit and suitable persons to be entrusted with the care of their minor children, and that the interests and welfare of such children are best subserved when under such care and control. That the presumption is like unto the presumption of innocence in a criminal case, ever present throughout the controversy, until overcome by the most solid and substantial reasons established by plain and certain proofs. Indeed, this presumption is essential to the maintenance of society, for without it, man would be denaturalized, the ties of family broken, the instincts of humanity stifled, and one of the strongest incentives for the propagation and continuance of the human race destroyed. That court went on to say, we recognize that in giving up Russell, these grandparents will suffer keen disappointment and sorrow. But in this case, if the instincts of filial and paternal affection are of any value, or if the voice of nature that makes the parent the natural guardian of his child would cause Rachel to weep for her firstborn and refuse to be comforted is worth anything, they furnish the only proper solution of this question. In the calm and peaceful solitude that must come to the hearts of these grandparents when Russell is gone, let them remember the love and affection they had for their own son, and realize that as they would have done it for them in a contest for their son, we now need the mother of this child give under her own. You wrote that opinion, not you, Justice, wrote that opinion. That opinion was in Wilson v. Mitchell, written 105 years ago by this court. I chose it because to me, as a natural parent, as an adoptive parent, as a foster parent, this touched me deeply. And so in answer to your question, it isn't sufficient to believe that in 1905-105, we have somehow, the legislature has somehow expressed the full extent of the right afforded to the natural parent. So my statement to you is, I could allow for the fact that Troxell, I could allow for the fact that the Court of Appeal used Troxell. It did cite the Wilson, and it could have relied on Wilson. It used Troxell to, beef it up, to bring it current. And there is something to bringing it current. And to add the elements of special weight and factors and add those elements. But your answer to the answer to your question is that no, 1905-105 doesn't do enough. And therefore, you superimpose a presumption in favor of the natural parent. And with that presumption comes what Fox allowed for, which is that weighted factors. And so when the Court of Appeals talked about it, they talked about it in the context of, okay, we're talking about best interests of the child. So what does one do? Specific to this case, what does one do? One examines the father. One examines what is it that the father can do to father these children. The court concluded that there should have been one presumption and way past the fact of him being the father, but also that the trial court should have tested whether or not the father was prepared for, able to take the children into his care. Recall, because one of the other things that the Court of Appeals said was, in addressing likelihood of substantial psychological harm, one of the things that the Court of Appeals said was that, and I've lost my train of thought, so I'll just move on. But anyway, allow me to continue.
Mr. Lasher, let me throw you a line here.
Okay.
So are you asking us to find that 1905-105 or the determination there unconstitutional in light of Troxell?
We have not. We have not asked that.
Do we need to?
I think you can interpret in light of Troxell the language of that section, the specific section of 1905-105. Excuse me. So what we need to do is, we're talking about the termination. We're not talking about custody. We're talking termination as a predicate to adoption in this particular context. So what we have to do is we have to look at what Judge Ide and what the others have been attempting to work through is, in fact, what does it take in order for a judge to terminate the rights of the father And there were essentially three parts. But one, the first part, it's essentially a two-part standard, as you know. One is the best interest of the child. And that's where all this discussion comes in, about the father. And so when we talk about the best interest of the child, then what this court can do is suggest, it doesn't have to declare it unconstitutional in terms of the trial. All it has to do is say, when assessing the best interest of the child, one shall give a special presumption, a particular presumption to the father. And then look at 3.2, which talks about the child. And on the child's side of that, the child's side basically says, specific to this best interest analysis, it says that there is a likelihood of substantial psychological harm. Should the child be removed? That's what it says. So let's think through that. So the way it should go is that the court should do an analysis which presumes in favor of the father. And that's not declaring this unconstitutional, it's simply saying that that's the way one should do it, in the form of Troxel. There should be special weight given to the father. There should be special factors which the court can consider. In this case, those special factors, given the circumstances of the case, were the factors surrounding the father's ability.
So can I interrupt you? So if the statute doesn't make this presumption, which you said should be presumed by Troxel, then it has to be unconstitutional. But that doesn't seem to be what you're arguing.
What I'm arguing is that it
could
is...
Could you be as specific as possible?
I'll be as specific as possible that that best interest of the child standard in 19.5 should be presumed to include, or should include by interpretation, a presumption in favor of the father. That is what I'm saying.
Well, why are you saying that? I mean, I guess I want to pursue a little bit more the factors. I mean, essentially, the factors, a lot of what we take into account just couldn't apply here, right? But that's right. Essentially, it was, I guess it's your position, and what the Court of Appeals suggested is that the father couldn't really establish this relationship, right? Because for obvious reasons. And the Court of Appeals really focuses on this lack of support. And can I get you to focus on that?
I can. Can I back up one step from it and
sure.
Get to it? I have 20 minutes and 13 seconds. What we know to be true is that it is a two-part standard to terminate the rights of the father in this circumstance. The one is the best interest, where a lot of time has been spent in terms of balancing interest, in terms of the presumptive interest in favor of the father. The other is that the court must find one or of three factors by clear and convincing evidence. The first was unfit and the court didn't do it. The second was the substantial relationship. And so there was time spent on whether indeed there was a substantial relationship. What's interesting to note, Not only did the Court of Appeals address it our briefing addressed it, suggested that there was a substantial relationship, there was a regular meaningful contact based on the fact of what father was allowed, but that's not where the Court of Appeals went. The Court of Appeals said, I heard it, but I'm not going there because there is an affirmative defense based on an impediment, and that's where the Court of Appeals went. The Court of Appeals said, and recall the facts in this case, that father, through the fault of the mother, through the actions of the interveners, was never given the opportunity to establish a relationship with his children. And so the Court of Appeals properly found that in clear language to be an impediment. And the interveners tried to argue, at least for their part in that, tried to argue that it was a good faith impediment, but the Court of Appeals said there's nothing about good, bad faith, it's about an impediment. And therefore, there was an impediment. So when we look at the three factors, the first was unfit, that's wrong, it was never argued. The second is substantial relationship, and that's wrong because of the affirmative defense of essentially impediment. So now you're left with a third. Because we can let go of the best interest of the child altogether, we choose not to because we think it's so important for this court to speak by the presumption.
But we can let go of it because it requires one of the three tours on that, at least the ones you're asking about. So I said I'm getting to it. So if you get there, what you're saying is that $250, this is from June until September, 3 months, $250, plus, we heard council talk about, well, you know, everybody has a support responsibility for food and clothing and shelter and all of those things. And that's precisely what Father provided. He provided food. He provided clothing. He provided a stroller. He provided car seats. He provided all of these things in addition to the $250. So what you have to do to turn this case, to reinstate the trial court, is you have to suggest that the issue of $250 in conjunction with all of the other things Father did for the children, for the time he was able to parent with them, you have to find that that wasn't sufficient. By clear and convincing evidence, you are going to terminate Father's parental rights based on that alone. It's not about best interest, it's not about anything else. It's about $250 and all that he did for his child while he was here. Then you look and you're thinking, well, wait, I would like to look at the children's code more in the collective. Okay, let's look at it in the collective. And then we look at step-parent adoption. And we see in step-parent adoption, case law, the statute, you can't terminate the parent's right and provide for step-parent adoption in a financial context unless a year has passed with no support and there's an unwillingness, a defined unwillingness to provide support into the future. My goodness, you want to reconcile the children's code. And so you've got one part of the code saying it requires you look at a year. And it also says, well, you know, a year, you know, we'll go off even farther in a year, because if he says he has a willingness to provide support, then work with it. So you think about that. And then,
Mr. Lash, can I ask if you were done?
Yes.
All right. Two questions. What did the trial court find in terms of the adopted parents' impediments providing an impediment?
I'm sorry. Yes.
What did the trial court find with regard to the foster adopted parents' impediment? Yes.
Exactly that.
What
they found was that it was a sort of excusable, found it was sort of an excusable good faith. So the trial court, and I get a specific page, but the trial court certainly recognized. What was interesting in the Court of Appeals is that the trial court.
I just wanted to know what the trial court.
The answer is that's what it held. It held it good faith impediment.
So did it find that they had impeded that in terms of the affirmative defense that you mentioned?
They recognized the fact and concluded that it was not an impediment because it was a good faith effort to restrict Father's parenting time with his children.
What do we do with that factual finding? Is that an abuse of discretion on behalf of the trial court judge?
I don't think it's a factual finding. I think it's an interpretation, it's a legal conclusion that impediment is defined by, we do it in good faith and that's good, that's okay. That's not a factual finding, that's a legal interpretation of this statute. That's saying, impediment, legislature being meant that it's okay.
All right, let me ask you one other factual question, which is, you talked about the food. Is that food that he brought to a visit, or is it food that he sent to the family to provide for the children?
It's food that he brought.
To the visits?
It's food that he brought to the visit. Again.
And how many visits were there?
22. I'm being correct. 22 visits. So, you know, when you think about it, the first argument they made was, it's a gift. Wow, that's a gift? No, as you later recognize, that's part of caring for your child. Food, clothes, your body parts, your body's stronger. You do that. And so to suggest somehow that I'm gifting every time I buy food for my child, it's pretty old now. Well, the day I did, it's hard to
deny it was
gifting. When you look at child support, and you know, there was an argument that, well, we don't look at 115. Well, we do look at 115. We can look at 115 because the trial court used the word child support. He used it more than once. So he was thinking in the context of child support. So when we look at child support, I do that law as well, and when we look at child support, we're recognizing that the legislator has created a collective responsibility. What you pay in child support is a differential payment. It is not a representation of what you pay to support your child. And so I cite cases in my brief which talk about the nature of supporting the child. It clearly includes food, clothing, shelter, certainly, but also strollers and car seats and all the things that the father provided. So to rest a termination on this element, the court found, rightly found, to be an abuse of discretion. And then there's the context. You know, we have a context, as I've shared, we have a context in the Children's Code. You have the context, which is step-parent adoption. But look at DNN. That's also part of the Children's Code. Give that context when you think about abuse of discretion in this one aspect. Think about a DNN, what one has to go through in order to terminate the rights of the parent and the DNN. There are diversion programs, there's a forced treatment plan, there are pages and pages of things that one must go through in order to terminate the rights of a parent and a DNN action. That's part of the Children's Code. Look at the relinquishment that precedes relinquishment of the father's rights, relinquishment of the mother's rights. Adoption Choices has a checklist of 21 items. 21 items that it requires be satisfied before it will allow for the relinquishment of a mother's rights. You ask about sort of the importance of this connection. It is rampant throughout the Children's Code. And so to somehow read this one section of the Children's Code, again, when you put it in the context of fraud, father had no choice. He had no chance. And if you look at them, they make reference to Lehrer versus Roberts, and I like that case. Not for the premise that they provide, but the premise is that the Supreme Court used Lehrer to say what they were looking for in Lehrer was to look at a New York statute. And what was the issue in the New York statute? Whether the father was given an adequate opportunity to create a relationship with his father. If he was, and if he blew it, then fine. But if he wasn't, and so look at our facts. Look at our facts. Our facts are that he was never given an opportunity to create this relationship with the children.
What's your position with regard to the liberty interests of the adoptive parents?
The Court of Appeals was correct in its statement regarding the fact that they...
Because it's void from the beginning. What if these children, let's set aside the fact that the children have been there for 2+ years. What if it's 10 years? What if it's 15 years?
Let's talk about it. Right, so what they tried to argue was that the adoptive parents are adoptive parents. And I would submit to you that that's clearly not the case, based on wide and other opinions. I would say to you that's not an argument. Then you go to the adoptive parents as custodial parents. And you ask that question. Recently. I'm not sure how recently, but you guys did an opinion with respect to foster care. It's AM versus, and I'm spacing.
MS.
I'm sorry?
MS.
Indeed, you may have written that in Justice Hope. I'm not sure. But why I bring that up is because in that case, it was a vehement action, and it was about the rights of the foster parents to participate in a termination. And foster parents being custodial parents, not unlike, I would submit to you, not unlike the interveners in this case. You did not, this court did not assign any constitutional liberty interest in the adoptive parents. In fact, what it did is it allowed for the adoptive parents to have full participation only because the actual statute did not define it. In other words, it basically listed the people that could participate, and so the court said, cool, we'll let you guys participate as we're participants. That's not this statute. Opposing counsel glossed over the fact that this statute has a specific provision, it specifically delineates the custodial parent, the custodian of the children, in a termination context where it limits, specifically limits the rights of the custodial parent. And then, if termination is not completed, if there is no termination of parental rights, then it allows for the custodial parent to have a much more participatory interest. Can speak about the best interest of the child and whatever. So the Court of Appeal was very clear that that was there as well, and that's not been challenged, as in fact the impediment has not been challenged before this court, but it's not been challenged. So what you've got a situation where this statute is very clear, very express, what that interest is in the custodial parent. That's what you've got. Now you go to, wait, third, let's default. Are they the adoptive parents? No. Do they have a special interest as custodial parent? I would submit no. Then you have it, is there an expectation as a prospective adoptive parent? And the answer is no. Under the facts of this case, they adopted these children adopted in December of 2012. Took them in custody upon birth in September of 2012, excuse me. But on February 6th, they were put on notice of fraud. They were put on notice. They knew. And in fact, as the Court of Appeals identified, in many of the documents that the intervener signed, they were fully aware that there may be this risk. There may be a risk that natural parent would come in and make a claim to the custody and care of these children. And so they knew, as soon as they read this plea, they knew. So are they reasonably expecting to be the adoptive parents? The answer is no.
Well, what about after the adoption? Are they not expecting to be the adoptive parents after adoption?
All right, I'll give you. I mean, I'm not even sure I'll give it to you, but let's talk about 2 months. 2 months. I'm saying 2 months. I'll give it to you from December to February. Maybe. They still have those documents. They still recognize that something could happen. But maybe. They have an expectation that they are. Well, at that point, they're adoptive parents, so it's not about expectation, right? The expectation occurs only when they are no longer legally adoptive parents. And so they have known, one, that their rights as adopted parents are likely to be terminated or avoided because of the fraud. They know that. And they know what is a likely outcome. Because if we talk about what should have happened, not that they haven't, but it should happen. In February, they know. In February, they know there was fraud. They didn't work to unify, to investigate, to do anything to support the interest. They didn't do anything. In fact, they resisted it with everything they had. They resisted parenting time. They even resisted the fraud. And we go to a hearing in June, and they have no evidence. None. Zero. No evidence. But they allowed it to be played out to June. So for all this time, they've done everything they can to preserve their relationship with the children and do nothing to facilitate a relationship between that parent and these children. It's very difficult. Again, I said, I'm an adopted parent. 5 months, I would have done everything I could to investigate to make sure that the natural parent was fit, proper, and I would have done everything I could to unify.
But you would agree that the foster parents had no participation, or the adoptive parents had no participation in the fraud.
I would agree with them. There is no indication. They knew of it. They knew of it in February. They knew it 2 months later. Did they know of it? No. Because there is a case, as you may know, in Utah, which has been brought back to Colorado, and Manzanera's case. Maybe someday you'll see it. In that case, the custodial parents were part of the fraud. No, I'm not suggesting they were part of the fraud. What I'm suggesting is that they impeded. They were not prospective adopted parents as soon as they knew of the fraud. And they didn't resist the fraud.
All right, thank you.
Yes. I have a minute. The Court of Appeals, in its opinion, reversed and remanded for a custody hearing, which is appropriate in 19-5105. As you know, in the event that there is no termination of the parental rights, then there shall be a custody hearing. What's cool about the Court of Appeals' opinion is that in that custody hearing, it is saying that presumption must attach. That presumption that the father is acting in the best interest of the children must attach. They must have given special weight to that in a custody hearing. What the Court of Appeals said is you need to give him a substantial opportunity to establish a relationship. But you and I know, after 2.5 years, pushing 3 years by the time your opinion comes out, we know that's...
I'm sorry, you can finish up.
So what I'm asking
is... You can ask us, but nothing more.
All right, I promise. I'm asking that you uphold the reversal and that in that remand for a custody hearing, that what you do is you adopt what is commonly being termed now as a unification plan, and that is what you do honor to the father's presumptive interest in the custody care and control of this child.
All right, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You have some rebuttal comment? Please, in 5 minutes and a half.
Excuse me.
Mr. Lasher raised the case Wilson v. Mitchell and then referred to Troxel and said, let's bring Wilson current by looking at Troxel. And if we bring Troxel current and we focus on what Troxel focuses on itself, which is what are the rights of a fit custodial parent. Troxel said, for example, the child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right, coupled with the high duty, to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations. Without getting into a discussion of what's happened over the last 100 years, bringing Troxel current, or bringing Wilson current, and relying upon Troxel shows that what we focus on now is the custodial relationship, the familial relationship. And that's what we've asserted the entire time. If we talk about the issue regarding the impediment in subsection 3.3 of the statute, there was an impediment that was created by the birth mother, but after the May 31, 2013 hearing where there was a finding of fraud and the order for termination was set aside, the court fixed the impediment. The court then gave MC the opportunity to establish a substantial positive relationship with the child, gave him the opportunity to take substantial parental responsibility of the child. And the reality is that he was unable to do that. He was unable to do that over that period of time. So when we got to the October 2013 termination hearing, by clear and convincing evidence, the trial court found he had not established a substantial positive relationship with the child or children, and that he had not provided regular and reasonable support as is required by subsection 3.1c of the statute. In fact, it's worth noting that when the trial court originally ordered visits between MC and the children, he specifically noted this may really hurt the adoptive parent's position in this case, but I'm going to give him the opportunity to establish a relationship with the children. He had the opportunity. He wasn't able to grasp it, and he wasn't able to establish the relationship that he needed to establish.
Was it a meaningful opportunity? I guess that's one of the questions. Under the peculiar circumstances of this case, did he really have a meaningful opportunity, or in some sense was he preordained to fail because of his circumstances?
And that's a really interesting question, because that same issue sort of arises as we approach the October 2nd and 3rd 2013 termination hearing. The MC stated he had established a substantial positive relationship. In his mind, he had enough opportunity to establish a substantial positive relationship. The guardian ad litem, other experts, the court ultimately found otherwise. So, in a sense, it was incumbent upon MC, when you say he was preordained to fail, the answer is no. If he felt that amount of time was not sufficient in order to establish that relationship that he needed, then it was incumbent upon him to say, I need more time. You have to give me the opportunity to establish this relationship. But that's not what he did. The only time he said, I didn't have enough time, was after the termination. Up until that point, up to the hearing, during the hearing, he absolutely argued that he had a substantial positive relationship. And maybe in there is where there's a disconnect, that he did not have the means, ability within himself to establish that relationship with these children. Now, had he recognized that, he could have asked for more time, but he didn't recognize that. He didn't recognize that, and that was set forth in the guardian ad litem's report that was found by the court, of the trial court. So, yes, he had the opportunity. No, he didn't grasp it. Now, in terms of the impediments that are being assigned to my client's adoptive parents, what the trial court found was that they did not impede, but that what they did in good faith was to act in the best interest of the children. To elucidate that a little bit, what happened was there was an order entered by the trial court right after the reinstatement of MC's rights. He said 8-hour visits, Saturday, Sunday, or Friday, Saturday, so twice a week, 8-hour visit right off the bat when he had only met the children once for an hour. So adoptive parents requested status conference, I think it was MC that requested status conference, and argument was held regarding what's appropriate moving forward. It was at that point in time the judge on his own said, this is too much. What I've said in terms of the parenting time of the visits is too much, we need to cut back. So what the adoptive parent did in good faith was say, we need to figure out what's best for the children here. We're going to have visits, we understand that, let's go slow. And frankly, that gives everybody the best opportunity to succeed here. The children, that was the primary concern. The children should not be placed in distress. Let's go slow, let's make sure that the children can be comfortable in the situation and like they can establish comfort and whatever type of relationship with MC. That's what the trial court found. The trial court found that the adoptive parents acted in good faith.
You need to finish.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We want to thank both counsel, or all counsel actually, for your arguments, and the court is in recess.